Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today I'm excited to welcome Andrew Kramer, principal at Bridgeview Asset Management. Since 2011, Andrew has led the acquisition and management of over 3,000 mobile home units, building a portfolio valued at more than $600 million. With degrees from Cornell and UC Berkeley, he brings a unique blend of science, finance, and operational expertise to the mobile home park sector. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You bet, man. Like we were talking about before you started, I have to say, as you got like probably the best first name, you know, as far as first names go.
Likewise. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's awesome, man. Would you mind just starting out by sharing a little about your story and how in the world you ended up in manufactured housing communities?
Yeah, sure. Of course. It's kind of scary. Sometimes I realize that I've been doing this a little while now, and 14 years is kind of like, oh man, I'm one of the old guys now. It's sort of depressing. I started my career, I guess, if you want to call it that. I originally went to school for chemistry of all things, and then was kind of outclassed from an intelligence standpoint at UC Berkeley, which is a phenomenal chemistry program where I was by far the dumbest guy there. So was really feeling out of place, and I got hooked into a mortgage REIT back in 2007. From there, jumped to a different REIT. So kind of got exposure to real estate just kind of almost by happenstance. And then kind of during the financial crisis, got laid off from that job, and then sort of worked my way into a few entrepreneurial things. And because of my wife's career, we ended up in Portland, Oregon. And that was originally, I was thinking I was going to be just a developer and I was going to build apartments and things like that. And I just never, we all learned this in real estate. It's an interesting insular tribal business in many ways. And so when you show up from the East Coast as a guy who's like, hey, everybody, I'm here now, that's not very well received. And in particular, it's like a guy in his 20s who really didn't know anything. I was sort of laughed out of a lot of rooms and was able to borrow 10% money. And the only thing that worked even back in the crisis, you know, you could buy apartments in Portland at like 7 and 8 caps, which I know sounds insane today. But, you know, back then it was like, who would ever do that? So it sort of, the only thing I could buy was a mobile home park. And that mobile home park I still own today. And it was a little 39 unit park. And I bought it at a 14 cap. And so it could pay my 10% equity. Yeah. So it was one of those things where, and I think that's one of the interesting things about mobile home parks in general is that even not that long ago, I mean, that was 13 years ago. That stuff was there. They were these like nasty little, oh my God, you want to do that? Like these very funny properties. And it really, in many ways, that stigma exists for, you know, it's funny. You and I are here talking. We're sort of in the industry. We understand RV parks and mobile home parks and single wides and park models. But for the most part, we ourselves get very insular too, I think. And we realize that for the vast majority of people, that initial stigma that we all had, the first park we walked into, is still very prevalent. But that sort of, so my experience was getting in there, and then every day I was there. I didn't know what else to do, so I managed it myself. We had to bring in 7 units, so, and I had no money. So I was like, well, I can't afford these new units. Everything was sort of on the fly. So I went to another, I found a used unit, and then I said, how do I move this? And so I called the tow truck guy, and the tow truck guy said, I can't move this. So everything, I kind of put it all together very slowly and painfully, but that was sort of, and it's interesting how the way you start is often how you keep doing things. And so because of my experience, I didn't like parachute down from a big private equity fund and have a bunch of money behind me. I was always sort of on the ground, and that's sort of how things got built up. So we did that park, refinanced it, bought another park up at Centralia, still own that one too, actually. And then from there, you know, hooked in with a hedge fund, did about 7 parks with them. Those were kind of round trips where you sold them. Really regretted selling. I think that for many reasons, not the least of which was sort of having to see those parks kind of do an arc of getting better and then get worse again. And that's really hard for me to see, particularly in a family park where you go into a property. And I remember one in North Portland we bought where there were 1,100 911 calls to this park the year before I bought it. So it was really rough. But then, you know, I've got some pictures posted all in various places that anyone wants to check it out. But the you know, it was just really, it looked like a dump in the front. We cleared all that out, brought in some nice new park models, and, you know, some tremendous rewarding things where you drive through a park for the first few months and it's just, there's no one outside. And then 6-8 months later, when you put a playground in, you see kids on the playground, and that's really cool to see. So that to me is tremendously rewarding, where you're able to provide something, not just you can start to build out a community just by doing these things that no one really wants to do. You know, like a burned out RV, you can't make a call. You can't call a guy who's going to go take care of that. You have to figure out, I better go rent a mini excavator, and I better go get a dumpster, and I better get an asbestos. Because, like, it's one of the funny things I find about the industry in general is that there's no specialist. It's all just, you have to kind of grab guys from various places and then they'll kind of do the work. So it's it's always very patchwork in my mind. I know that's changing now a little bit, but that's sort of, my experience is always that you couldn't just, you know, your average demo guy is not going to set foot in a mobile home park. Your average, you know, if you have a single wide mobile home that you want to do a rehab on, you know, you call 10 GCs, none of them are going to do a mobile home. They just don't want to do it for a variety of reasons. And so you're like, okay, well, I guess I better find some guys. And so that was how I started a construction company for that exact purpose, because I just couldn't find anyone to do it. So then, you know, for a while there, about 7 or 8 years, I had my own construction company. And now we've sort of backed off a little bit to where we sort of handle project management. And I think that's largely a function of the industry coming along a little bit, but also us just really understanding the things we need to keep in-house and kind of getting really, really good at as small a number of things as you can. So that's sort of, we've always really been on the value add side of things, and we're kind of transitioned through working with some, I call them sort of ultra high net worth family office types who were sort of in dedicated partnerships, to now we've kind of transitioned into a more traditional syndicated model. So I think it's been an interesting transition working with different partners, and then really kind of figuring out the things that I really enjoy doing, the things that the company, that Bridgeview's gotten really good at doing, and then kind of figure the place we want to be in. So we, you know, we kind of have very, very specifically chosen the sort of greater Pacific Northwest. And we really focus on these types of value add deals because, kind of like I said before, it's like I got used to that. And I found that there's a little bit of a niche in high vacancy, utility problems, you know, the sort of non-institutional grade properties. We feel we can be very impactful, both from an investment standpoint, but also kind of in building up these properties and making a difference for the tenants as well. So that's kind of the box we try and stay in.
I love it. So tell me, back to that first park, and thank you for that synopsis there. I have several questions. Take the first park, like, how'd you get educated? Were you just like, hey, I'm just going to figure this out? You know, what were the utility setups? Did you go to the boot camp or do something, you know, to get updated? Or were you just like, hey, I'm going to figure this out?
I never said that. That's how it worked out. I wish I had done more of the sort of the educational steps. I think it was funny. I remember the day before closing, I drove through the park because I just thought that's what you do. And I looked through and I counted the units, and there were 5 units gone. And I came to realize, I called the broker, that the seller of the property, she owned a lot of parks in the area. And so she had yanked out 5 units, like literally days before. And I just thought, it's never happened to me since in, you know, 35 parks, but in the moment I was like, oh my God, this is how this industry, like, people are like kind of just, so sure. It was just, yeah. I didn't know, but so that was like, I guess this is how this, because right, technically legal, right? She sort of got these tenants to move to another one of her parks. I'm sure she paid to move the units, whatever. And anyway, so that I'll never forget that. She's become like, she's just a character. So I don't have a grudge against her for that, believe it or not. But I should. And, you know, it's funny. I didn't have any background whatsoever. And I think there were some advantages and disadvantages. The advantage was I didn't know what I was getting into. And this park had a huge amount of tenant issues. We ended up evicting like six people within the first 6 months. But I learned, you know, I got to do all of the steps. I did the filings. I did the 72-hour notices. I did the first appearances. I didn't have any money. I couldn't hire an attorney. Same thing with like tearing out a unit. I hired six guys and paid them $15 an hour, whatever it was, and was there. So I think if I'd had more real estate experience, I think I would have said like, wait a minute, where's the licensed bonded guy who's going to do all this stuff for me? He doesn't exist. Oh my God. So I didn't have like a background in apartments or single family homes where I would have had that expectation. So I think in many ways, the lack of education sort of helped me. And it's 40 units. It was sort of, I could get my arms around it. Yeah. And not necessarily if it had been 200, I think I would have never made it work. And, you know, I same thing like with landlord tenant stuff. I mean, like that, I'm sure kind of coming from more landlord friendly places, the Pacific Northwest seems like a just a nightmare from a regulatory standpoint. And it is, but it's all I know. Had I bought a bunch of parks in North Carolina and then come here, I'm sure it would have been, or Texas, I'm sure it would have just been like, I wouldn't have known how to handle it, but I'm just used to it. So I think being naive and having no experience and just sort of like building up a knowledge base within this sort of very confined environment, I think in many ways served to help me, because now we can very conclusively say like, hey, we're specialists in this area. And, you know, we know all the little nuances and subtleties and how to go through sort of even just the permitting nightmare of like bringing in a home in most of the places in the Northwest. It's just such a, compared to other places, it's nuts. But again, it's sort of all we've ever done. So
you're used to it. Tell me real quick. I'm very curious about, you said you did seven parks with a hedge fund. Mm-hmm. And maybe tell me about that, because I've been approached by PE firms and the mm-hmm. like, and they're like, hey, we're going to bring all this money. And I've always shied away from them, you know, for some of the reasons you mentioned, like, you know, there's always like a sale date, right? Like you're going to have to sell these assets and close out the fund or whatever. So maybe just tell me about how that experience was and working with institutional capital and, you know, the positives and minuses, if you don't mind.
I think overall it was a great experience. I think those guys were extremely helpful and they were very patient, and they kind of gave me a window into, as you said, sort of the institutional world and the expectations of an institutional investor. I think there are some just realities that are complicated. As you said, like there's usually like a 5 max, sometimes 7 year turnaround. And then you kind of, you know, at least with me, like I was a very, very small part of a much larger fund. And so like, if they're closing out a fund and your little park is sort of one of the last assets, like you're not going to get another year to really crank it, because if it's a $4 million park today and a $4.5 million park tomorrow, it doesn't move the needle. So I think you often kind of get like, you will get marginalized sometimes. So I think like structurally it was difficult. I was very lucky because the people who I was working with were tremendously supportive and really kind of understood what I was trying to do and were, you know, very, very accommodating. And they kind of thought it was cool that we could, you know, like, we need a construction company. I'll start one. Let's go do this here. They were extremely flexible.
Supported you in that. Yeah. I've heard stories where, you know, hedge funds are kind of the opposite, where like they're less flexible. They're very, very stringent, and you're going to follow my rules. And so that's cool that you had a good experience. And, you know, did you know someone with the hedge fund beforehand?
I did.
You got introduced to them?
Yep, definitely. And so that was really helpful. And I completely agree with you. There's, I think it could have been way worse if it had just been, you know, like I'm handed off to some vice president who, you know, like calls me 9 times a week and you need to go and give a presentation to people you've never met and get sort of raked over. Like it could have been way worse. And that's why, like, I don't necessarily think for me personally, you know, going back into like talking to like a, you know, going to KKR or Invesco or one of these big giant funds, like I think if under the right circumstances, it might work great. And the right circumstances would be like knowing the people, just like anything, right? It doesn't matter if it's a, you know, if it's a limited partner and you've got a whole bunch of documents that really stipulates control, or if it's a giant fund. Like I've had a lot of experiences with a lot of different investors, and the structure has been much less impactful than the people. Like an LP who's behind you know, three documents that says you, the operator, gets to do whatever you want. He can do nothing. That person can still be a nightmare versus like I've had some, you know, literal like complete majority partner is this guy and I'm the minority partner. And they make, you know, from a legal standpoint, they can make all the decisions and those have worked great. I mean, I had one exactly like that, that I worked with a family for, you know, probably like 5 or 6 years. And it was, I mean, my ability to sort of control my destiny, it was extremely disadvantageous because they controlled everything. But in the end, I think it worked extremely well. We got to accomplish goals that were in tandem with one another, if that makes sense. And then when we started to diverge, we both understood that and were able to kind of separate these affairs in a very sort of, you know, fair and professional way, I guess. And so that's sort of like, had that been a person, you know, that could have gone way worse for me. And the structure was not great looking back on it. But I think, you know, you got like
a track record, right? You built a track record.
That's exactly right.
Just like my first investor by far got the best terms. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't even let me take a property management fee. You know, and that was all my promote, you know? So like it was very advantageous, but it was a person and he took a huge risk on me.
That's right. Yeah.
And he deserves every bit of the good returns he got because of that. And it worked out. Right. And,
yeah.
And he was, you know, we still own those parks to this day. My first park, we still own it. Right. Yep. So I think there's something to be said about just good people and, you know, having a common goal and working together.
It's hard because sometimes you learn those lessons in reverse. And I think, I don't know about you, but in the moment, there were moments where I was like, I shouldn't, this is totally unfair. But as you said, it's like, well, because you only know yourself in the moment. And so when you think, like, you think you know what you're doing, you think you deserve this stuff. But I look back at 10 years ago, it's like, no one had any reason to think I was capable of doing all this stuff. So
seriously,
I think I would like to think that everybody kind of feels good about those transactions. And I think, but you know, certainly from looking at it sort of, with like the cards on the table, I feel like everybody ended up doing really well. So I think that's important, but yeah. So I think
tell us about your operations. Tell us about your property management company and scaling up to 3,000 units is no easy task. Like it's very, very difficult.
Yeah.
There's all these like levels where things break and then you have to rebuild it. So tell us about like your challenges and what your team looks like today.
Yeah. So we ramped up over the course of about 6 years. And we went from managing, you know, 5 parks to managing 35 parks. And then, so during that time, what we always had was I'm very sort of development heavy. And so I always had a really good team of kind of, I would call them project managers. So guys who really understand when we walk into a new property, we say, all right, we have this utility upgrade to happen. You know, we have to replace the water line here. We've got to add 6 used units here. We're going to put a trash compactor here. We've got to do electric upgrade. So like, and to kind of compartmentalize that work and then find the right people to do it. Because again, if it was an apartment building, I could get 3 bids from 3 very qualified GCs who do that stuff all the time. We have to kind of step in a little bit more to like that GC developer role where you're saying, all right, you got to bid out the electric, you got to bid out the plumbing. Sometimes you got to get all the way down to like renting the equipment and getting a equipment operator to be on the mini X at your direction for 2 days. So that's, again, kind of going back to like how I started things. It's been interesting the last couple of years because we went from, we were way, way, way scaled up to that big, you know, several thousand unit scale. And then we kind of scaled back down because with some of our partners, we ended up sort of, instead of owning, you know, a minority percentage of 35 parks, we now own a majority percentage of 20 parks. So actually we had closer to 40 at one point. So anyway, our management infrastructure is really built out for a much bigger portfolio. So for the last year or so, we've been kind of retinkering and figuring out the next thing to do. And so now we're sort of going back out and, you know, we're going to buy 3 more deals this year. And we've got another probably 4 or 5 in Q1 and Q2 of next year. So we're sort of rebuilding, but we kind of had like, we were sort of overstaffed, I guess, for a year or so, which obviously hurts from a capital standpoint and a cash flow standpoint. But ultimately I just decided that the company, I really liked the team and it made more sense to kind of bring some new work in as opposed to try and like really, really pare down and just kind of manage the portfolio we had. So I think from a scaling standpoint, you know, one thing I will say is I feel like the software systems have come a long way. I also think it's a little scary to me sometimes because like some of the bigger, you know, like you take AppFolio, these are very, very like, they're being invested in very heavily. So like they're adding a ton of features, as are like the payroll companies, that like all of these like service providing third parties. I think it's largely just because of like cloud infrastructure and how efficient these places can suddenly be. They're also getting I think they're taking a lot of investment. And so that investment means they're adding a bunch of functionality, which is really cool. But I also worry that like a year or two from the pricing will go up, but also like at a certain point, you know, knowing the venture capital world and the private equity world, like if they can't show a return on this, they're just going to split. And now suddenly you're very committed to this software system that's not really going to work very well. So that concerns me. I hope it doesn't happen. From a scalability standpoint, it's made things tremendously efficient. And I think the ability of like, you know, even a couple of years ago, we switched from one software system to another, and it took like 8 weeks just to like, we had to do some manual transcription because the two systems didn't talk to one another. Now, all of that's a foregone conclusion because with like all these AI visual reading systems, it doesn't matter anymore. So I think that's from a sort of like high level accounting, you know, blocking and tackling payroll, all that stuff. There's so many third party resources that are great. I think the hardest thing to scale in my mind is sort of like just making sure you have people who understand the importance of execution and who understand the importance of like getting things done. It's hard to find a third party, probably in any industry, who really understands that. It's like, all right, like what is the, if we're bringing these six units in, where are they coming from? Are we going to try and work with multiple people? Another thing I found is like the scale's gotten bigger is partnering and not trying to like scrape every dollar off the table for yourself is a mistake I've made a lot in the past, where it's like, if there's someone who wants to bring in a unit and rehab it and sell it, and I don't make a dime and I don't even charge them space rent, almost always that's a great thing to do because it's not on your plate. And you now end up, what do you end up with? A nice home in your park. And that's what you want. And don't try and scrape the few thousand bucks every time you can. I guess that's been a really, in more recent years, I've realized that. Yeah. And sometimes you just focus on what is your business goal when you've bought this property or this is whatever your business is, but like focus on the goal and don't try and like, because I've been amazed where a few thousand dollars can oftentimes like be the difference maker in what can be a really productive partnership with somebody. And like I have a great partnership in Eastern Washington with a home dealer, believe it or not, who brings homes into my, and I'm money out to help him get the home set up. And then when the home sells, everybody gets paid. It works phenomenal. I don't have to worry about it. And whereas maybe even 5 years ago, I would kind of want to be like, no, you got to give me a commission here, or I got to make, you know, I got to make a contractor fee on my setup, little stuff like that, where it would have equated to, honestly, when us is probably like $2,500 a unit. And it just, and the amount of friction, those like relatively small amount, don't get me wrong, $2,500 is a lot of money, but like the friction it creates and what could otherwise be just like a tremendously fruitful partnership. So I found that's been, you know, not leaving some, like leaving some upside for other people. Upside. Yeah, it really, and like the other benefit of that is that most people don't do that. And so
you can become more homes into your park versus others, right?
Because everybody else is like, can bring homes in, but like, I'm not going to pay for it. And you got to pay space rent day. Like, so it's a really just being a little more like collaborative and just like getting to talk to you. Like I feel like there is a little bit more of that. I feel like we all sort of have, I don't want to say common enemies, but like the regulatory burden is so high. Like there's no point, like the even the guys who work in, you know, we're sort of in two different geographies, but you know, the guys who are in my competitors, I suppose you'd call them, like they're much more collaborators than anything. And you know, getting to like buying properties from someone who you know and trust and who has a reputation that they care, like it gets a lot easier as opposed to just trying to fight everybody all the time. So I think that's like having a much more collaborative mentality has been really helpful, I'd say, for in the last like 3 or 4 years versus trying to just, you know, fight all the time.
Let me ask you this. How are you sourcing new opportunities to invest in? Like, are you working with brokers? Do you try to find off market stuff, or where's most of
your I think the whole, like, the off market deal sort of ethos, I always find a little bit funny. Like, everyone's sort of obsessed with it in a weird way where it's like, this is off market. It's like, okay, is it good? Like, why is it off market?
It's a worse deal than you could have gotten on market.
All the time. So yes, we absolutely do. Having said that, I would say, you know, the brokerage community, at least out here, I think that they're pretty good at bringing deals. They're pretty good at pricing them fair. They're pretty good at setting seller expectations. So I would say, you know, a solid, I'd say probably half are listed in some way. And by that, I don't mean listed like on LoopNet or something, but, you know, just like a broker's involved, let's call it. And then, yeah, I mean, the off-market thing is sort of interesting because there's times where, as you just said, like sometimes an off-market deal is off-market for a reason, or you get a, you know, we're working right now with a property that we own some parks in the area. It's the sellers are in their 80s. And they're just fixated on this price. And then they call me about once every 6 months and they say they're ready to sell. And then, you know, I make an offer and they're pissed off. And so they go away for another 6 months. So like the off-market thing is great and you can get some great value, but it takes a long time. And I think that's you have to be established and you have to be in an area where people, and then that's where like, not just having really bad reputation can really hurt you. And if you have a reputation for kind of screwing over sellers, like that doesn't help you. And because like every time I've had an off-market transaction, there's always a call to someone I bought a park from, or and you got to be able to treat those guys. And if those guys think you're horrible to work with, that, you know, a broker can kind of manage that a little bit. But if you don't have a broker involved, like that seller is really going to be a very sensitive individual. So you have to be really careful with how you're managing yourself. So I think the short answer is like, I'm not one of these, like everything's off market and no one ever sees the deals I do. So it just, I think you got to be a little more, you know, particularly, I got to be in.
Cast a wide net, you know?
Yeah. And I can't just be in Portland or just in Seattle. Like we're mainly in the eastern side of the states right now, because we're seeing tremendous opportunities there. And then everything gets even more focused, where if you're in a town of 10,000 people, it's really easy to get a bad reputation, particularly when you're an out-of-town person. So you really have to take the time to go out, meet the concrete guy, meet the framers, meet the electricians, and just so they understand that you're not just coming out of nowhere.
That's good advice for any mobile home park, right? Like to know your vendors. Like we bought a park and there was 3 plumbers in town. Like that was it.
Right.
And they all had bad relationships with the previous owner. So the previous owner just used to do all the plumbing himself. And so we called these plumbers and they're like, oh, you're with that mobile home park? No, we don't do work there. So we had to like meet them in person, build back the relationship because something happened. We never got the full story.
Yep.
But you know, it's really, really important because otherwise, you know, you're thousands of miles away. How are you going to get anything done?
Well, and then it's not only the distance, but it's also just the attitude and reputation. And so if you do have to do something, like you're going to get kicked to the bottom of their list and you're going to get the worst pricing, because it's amazing. That's what it's so funny that even in this like hyper connected world, in the end, like it's particularly like in the sort of particularly like in the subcontractor trades, like relationship really matters. And if they trust you and if they know that they're going to get paid and if they know that you're not going to come back 9 months later with some ridiculous warranty complaint, they're going to take care of you. And that you can't, that's hard to communicate with like a LinkedIn profile. It's hard to communicate like a with a website.
Circle. Yeah. There's like a full circle moment there. It's like relationships matter with your vendors. They matter with your lenders. They matter with, you know, your hedge fund investors.
Of course.
If there's one major point to take away from this podcast, it's even the small relationships matter. So 100%.
You can't automate that. You can't build a bubble around yourself that prevents that. And I think I've seen that work in where I've, you know, there are people who have tremendous, like huge amounts of capital, who are able to like write a check from their own money and they want to be in the, and it, for some reason, something about them is just unappealing, where even like a you know, the brokerage community who you'd think would be all over something like that. They just won't deal with them because they don't want to. Yeah. And so that's something you got to be very conscious of, where even if you feel like you have the resources and you're the guy, that isn't going to get things done. if you don't value these, if, you know, if you don't take the time, as you said, to sort of really value and build a build trust and build some level of network and within whatever you're doing.
Totally. Let me ask you this, Andrew. Looking back at your career so far, what's one deal that stands out as a game changer and what made it so successful?
I would say the one that really stands out to me is I bought a park. This is a funny one because I've owned it three separate times with, so now I own 100% of it. I had one investor group I bought it with. We sold it to another investor group. And then as part of that transaction I was telling you about where we kind of broke apart a portfolio, I ended up with this park. So, and I think about it because you looked at this and it was just such a nightmare because there was just trash everywhere, utilities, non-functional, failed septic system, wires hanging out of every single meter. And when I look back on it, it's a 40 unit park. It's so not huge, but it's on like 15 acres. It's kind of like in a rural, semi-rural area on your way out to Mount Hood. But it's also, and I look at what we actually had to do, and so we had to bring in 40 yard dumpsters to clear out that park, which is like
40
insane. Except for when you think about it, it's like, well, that was all in, and that's like, that was about, you know, $60,000 to do all of that. And that's like, that's a big sum of money, but in the scheme of what is now like a $5 million property, like Not a whole lot. Right. And it was One of those things where I couldn't hire a third party to manage that for me, but I could hire three guys with three mini excavators and the municipal waste company dumped. They just kept pulling dumpsters and resetting them up. And it wasn't that complicated. It was not complicated. Yeah. It was not expensive in the scheme of things. It was transformative from, as I'm sure you can imagine, right? Like going from just like that much trash. So the tenants after, and it took 3 weeks to get all that done. So like the timing wasn't significant, the expense wasn't significant, and the complexity wasn't significant, but it was transformative. And I learned when I saw all that kind of shakedown, because I didn't know, we just walked in and be like, okay, let's do something. Let's get dumpsters. Let's get mini excavators and let's start picking up trash and putting it in the dumpster. Like that was my whole thinking at the start of this.
It's not rocket science, right?
It's not chemistry. Complicated. No, it's not. You know, and logistically, it's fairly simple too, right? Like I'm not invading Iraq. Like it's a fairly simple three-step process, but I still take this away where the most, like the stuff that is just sort of gross never tends to be very expensive or complicated. So like, I think about this with septic systems too, because as I'm sure you've had these conversations where you have a lender say, is it on septic? Yes. Whoa, wait a minute. It's like, listen, and you know, like, here's why I like that. And it's just, it's gross. I get it. It's raw sewage. But when you actually go in and fix those problems, they are never very complicated. And just like that, I always think about that in that context of the most impactful things you can do. That's not a linear chart with complexity and expense. Like you can do a ton that happens quickly, isn't very expensive, and adds, number one, adds tremendous value, but also can be transformative. And now like you, and that's what I always think with a new project is what can you have to, it's not only what are the things we want to do to add value to this for our investors. It's also the order in which we do those things and having, I place very real value on, you know, another example would be like locking mailboxes. You can't like, those don't reduce any expenses, right? Like there's not a mail expense on your P&L, but I found that same thing, right? Like you can, they cost about, I mean, like we're doing one now at a property we just bought and it's going to cost, I think it's 100 unit park. It's going to cost us $30,000 to install locking mailboxes, but from a, particularly with, you know, in any, like for low income residents, for older residents, mail theft is so destructive beyond what we can really comprehend. And so suddenly when you come in and now the mail is secure, and they don't have to worry about their sometimes medications or social security checks being stolen, it's a huge difference. So I think always thinking about it in terms of going to do the work, going to do the hard work, and
and sweat don't, equity, you know, and just the value add is what you're talking about, you know.
But it's also not, the value add is not like building a high rise or spending, you know, spending $100,000 of space to do some massive upgrade. It's oftentimes, I just find it very interesting when you look at the properties that that are eschewed by the sort of agency and institutional community.
Yeah.
I often find, number one, that those properties from an investment standpoint offer by far the highest return. But they also, they're not that complicated. It's just, you drive by a park that's got utilities that look bad and it's got trash all over the place and it's got a burned out unit that gets rid of 90% of the buyers because they just don't, they don't know. And it's scary. And it's like, oh, what do I do here? And I just found sometimes those problems that look bad, the more you are able to sort of address those, the rewards are always threefold, right? Like you have a community that's grateful, you have a great return for your investors, and you end up with an operationally sound project that didn't take, you know, those dollars on those types of things are so much more valuable than.
And to compare it to multifamily, right? Where like we've all seen it, the pitch decks where their value add is, hey, we're gonna replace all of the faucets with aerated faucets. You know, and we're going to spend all this money to do that to reduce our water bill. They get way granular and way complex with it, where it's like, hey, we're going to take this trailer park that's been, you know, abused for 30 years by a mom and pop owner that we're squeezing every penny out of it. We're going to reinvest into it, justify the rent increases, and boom, we added the value. Yeah, I think it's the most. And I bought self storage, and that was a whole nother avenue of creative value add where you're revenue managing people and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to squeeze every penny out, and it's less black and white compared to mobile home parks. Way less black.
Yeah. I think, and that's, I like to, not to hammer this too much, but I think that whole, that stigma side of this, and that's really, I think what's really hard for me to see is people missing out on a great opportunity where if you have someone who's making $15 an hour in the Pacific Northwest, which is, you know, not really a living wage, that person can buy a home and now they can pay a mortgage, which has tremendous tax advantages. And at the end of year five, they have equity in that home. And so I think what frustrates me is that story, no one believes. I've shown the math. I've done all the analysis. It's on the Bridgeview website. And people still like, yeah, but no. I'm like, well, actually, yes. As long as these things happen, as long as you have ethical management, actually, yes. And so now that person where if they're in an apartment, we've calculated over 5 years, at least out here, it's the math actually pretty much translates anywhere in the country. That 5 years adds $55,000 of wealth to that person. If you compare a 2-bedroom apartment in any given market to buying a home in a comparable manufactured home park, $55,000. And if you're making $15 an hour, that's transformative. And I think what the biggest impediment to that is the stigma. And I think what we, you know, we're here talking, you know, this is sort of I love it, but it's, you know, we're sort of investor focused and that's great. But someone who's just looking to afford a 2-bedroom apartment, that whole like stigma that in some ways for like the investment community is sort of funny. It trickles down to the working class population. It's very real. And they'll say, well, shit, if these guys are saying that this is sort of gross trailer trash, I don't want to be a part of that. And it really, it materially hurts what could otherwise be a great investment opportunity for people. So I think that's like, you know, the stigma around investment is certainly changing and this is becoming a much more institutional asset class and all that good stuff. But the stigma, I do find the problem now is like that stigma is really, really hurting a smaller group of people who are the last people that need to be, disadvantaged financially.
Fragile tenant base is very fragile. Sure. No, that's really good insights there. On the flip side, is there maybe a specific deal that didn't go as planned that maybe you can share and we can learn from?
Yeah. I think there's another one this is getting back to what we're talking about relationships. And I kind of came in and there's, you know, look, this is again, only in hindsight, I felt I had a very good argument to do a bunch of things in this property. The city disagreed. And I, instead of kind of trying to reach resolution, I just dug in and I started fighting them immediately. And I wrote a bunch of articles and went to city council, and in the end, where it stands now is the property is kind of okay. It's sort of, you know, a little bit better than break even because I guess it pays its mortgage and I don't have to feed it anymore. But most of that could have been avoided if I had just not had such a sort of brazen attitude going in and demand that I'm, and it, you know, and in the, it was a tricky one because even today, like I think I technically was right in my arguments for, in this case, adding density to this park. But sometimes being right isn't as important as understanding that you're going to have to figure out a way to get along with someone. And I just didn't like the city. I didn't like the people. And I was like, you guys are wrong. I'm right. And here's why. And you have to, that was the crux of all of the problems, I think. And so I, you know, we ended up having to spend a bunch of money there that we, you know, we just didn't really have to. And I think the like incremental gains that I ended up with today versus if I just, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, just like sat down and said, okay, guys, what can we do here? Mm-hmm. And just sort of accepting that that was going to be the reality. That was a hard lesson to learn. I think what I take away from it is being right, particularly dealing with like the government, whether it's a local government or that, like, it doesn't really matter. And you have to just, there's points where there's fights you can't win. A guy who, great mentor in his 80s now, was in mobile home park management for a million years. And I'm sure he took this quote, but you know, sometimes a bad deal is better than a good fight. I think that's probably a quote from some World War II general, who knows. But yeah, I really like, I think it's a great, it's I always keep it in the back of my mind where like, if you feel like you're getting screwed a little bit, even though you feel like you've got great posture to go take someone on, like it just isn't worth it
in the end.
That's kind of an ego thing, right? You want to be the guy who wins. You want to be the guy who can stand up and be like, yeah, but it doesn't, you got to kind of get yourself out of the way. Particularly when you're dealing with, when you're dealing with investor funds and things like that, you got to put your ego aside. And I think that, so that was, you know, there are a lot of things happened in that property, but I think that was the biggest one when I look back, is that I should have just accepted that. And that created the vast majority of the problems there.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us. And that's,
Of course.
That's a tough situation all around. We've all ran into, you know, cities that have the, you know, extra regulation, or they're just really strict and they're really wanting to, you know, like we ran into one that's like, it was legal non-conforming, but they were really adamant that no homes could be brought in that were older than 5 years old. And so we were like trying to fight back. And it, like you said, at a certain point, you're not going to get very far, and the attorneys are all who's going to win.
And you'll win. You'll win a few times, and then you'll get the state involved, and the state will come and like slap the city. But then guess what? Now you've made a massive enemy out of the code enforcement guy who got like lectured, and now he hates you. And like he, you know, you can claim, I've done this, you can claim that like he's being unfair. You can claim it's discriminatory. You can claim all that, but it's not going to work. And then you've got this guy who can make your life miserable. And it's really, usually like, you know, you can win every fight and you still end up in this like awful position. So you know, back to like relationships, right? Like even people you don't like and you don't want to like, you have to figure out a way to get along with them, or it's very, very self-damaging.
It's good advice. Real quick, we have a little lightning round here. I'm going to ask you 5 questions. Just tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. All right.
Got it.
If you could own every park in one state, which one would it be and why?
Every park in one state, Montana.
Montana.
Because it sees, I think there's a, the quick answer is Montana is a recreational market that's transitioning to a multifamily market. And I think there's tremendous opportunity when that happens, going from like a overnight RV recreation campground into more of a developed multifamily market. So Montana.
It's good. One state you would never own a mobile home park in?
New York.
New York, that's a good one.
California is a close second, but probably New York would be my first one.
Question 3, what's the biggest myth about mobile home parks you'd like to bust?
That you can raise rents forever. and there's never going to be any problems. I really hate that. I hate hearing it. Sam Zell said it. It drives me nuts. And it's a dumb way to think because there are tremendous repercussions, even in a non-rent controlled market. There are tremendous repercussions to that attitude. And I every time I hear it, I cringe. And that notion of like, your tenants are stuck there. They can't leave. And I hear lenders say it. It's not true. And it's very destructive.
Yeah. People will leave. Yeah, for sure.
Or they don't leave. And then you have people who can't afford to live in the home they own and they call the attorney general. And and in my mind, that's a legitimate complaint that person has. So, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
First image that pops into your head when you hear mobile home park.
What I see now is like some of the really, really modern, cool park models we've designed. So when I hear that, I think of all the potential that could exist. I don't really think of even what's around today or even the parks I own. I think that there's tremendous potential in very, very efficient design, construction, affordable housing. So I have a ridiculously optimistic view when you say mobile home park, but I'm not changing it. I don't care. I know it's ridiculously optimistic, but I don't care.
That's awesome. If lot rent caps, like rent control, you know, became law tomorrow, how would you pivot? Which I know you're already operating in some of those states, but yeah, how do you pivot around those?
Rent control creates a unique set of opportunities. And I think it eliminates a lot of buyers just on principle, and it magnifies what you can do as opposed to, so like raising rents is a very easy business plan. And when you can't do that, or you can, it's like you're forced into a lot of strategic things. So expense reduction is one, infill is another one. How can you add units effectively? The interesting thing about rent control that I found, rent increases used to be a very big thing. Every month, you know, my property manager and I would get together, we'd look at what the market rent, how much could, blah, blah, blah. And now it's just a foregone conclusion, which I think is ironic. I've written some articles about this, but what happens with rent control is, you know, Andrew Keel might have a park that's at market and you might say, all right, I'm at market, tenants are happy, I don't need to raise the rents. It's like, well, what if you have to repave it? It's like, well, then I'll deal with that in 3 years. Now your mentality is totally shifted. It is no longer, do I need to raise rents? It's how much can I raise the rents? And everybody does it. So
yeah,
they don't really track this, but I'm virtually positive that if you look on a per unit basis, rents start to go up way more once rent control is initiated because nobody can leave their rents the same. And we all did that before. If we're at market, no one raises your rents. So rent control creates sort of this, rents are no longer a thing. Yeah. Now I don't even know. Yeah, like we raise them, we raise them however much the state tells us to. So I think it's a destructive policy for a lot of reasons. But again, if you guys check out the Bridgewood website, I've written a bunch of stuff about it. But yeah, I think it focuses your business plan down to improvements. And I kind of, in a weird way, I kind of like it because that's what we've always done. We've always really focused on infill, utility repairs, reducing operating expenses. Yeah. And I think that
value. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think now it's just when you eliminate the buyers who are more like not tactical, but who are more sort of strategic, I suppose, and thinking like, all right, I'm going to, this market has a market rent of $750. We can buy this park at $500 a month and raise the rents $250. Like, it's those guys are gone. And so it really kind of opens up interesting buying opportunities for, you know, I'm a fairly small operator in the scheme of things, but being competitive on big giant institutional deals, I probably wouldn't have that opportunity. I hesitate to say it. I don't want to get crucified by every investor, but like, I don't think I wouldn't view rent control universally as a bad thing. I guess I think there's operational advantages to it.
Creates opportunity. Yeah. Because institutions, they don't want to infill. They don't want to do all that hard value add. They just want to raise rents. So yeah, that's a really good point.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Andrew, for, you know, if you were going to be a passive investor looking to invest in a mobile home park deal, you know, what's a couple pieces of advice you would give that passive investor, you know, just from your knowledge?
I would say understand the town would be the first thing. Understand where Ellensburg, Washington is versus another place. Like, and that doesn't mean like jump on a plane and fly out there. If you can, great. But understand that Seattle is not better than Walla Walla, Washington, or Spokane, Washington, or even like Yakima, Washington. Like, understand that the basic metrics of like MSA and proximity to a major airport and median income, all of these like big giant things that like JLL and Coldwell Banker put in their big reports, those are impactful only to a point. And so if you're looking at, if you want to invest as a passive investor, find a town you like, find a place that's showing interesting growth that you, and then from there, I would say, you know, figure out, and then like from a finding good operators, I think is a whole, you know, that's a whole different thing. But I would say, or if you find someone you want to work with, you know, pick an investment or pick a strategy that you feel like you can kind of check in on, and then really understand, just like I was saying about, you know, have a very clear business goal and be okay leaving money on the table. I think if you're a limited partner, I would do the same thing. Like I would take, you know, I would go into an Andrew Keel Park, a guy with a track record, and maybe the promote is 50-50 or 60-40, and versus like trying to go in to someone else who has less of a track record, and maybe the pref is 10 and you're getting only, the promote's only 30. Like, don't get greedy. Find somebody who understands what they're doing, who's willing to talk to you and answer questions, who has kind of, you know, I think the, as you were saying about some of these, like some of these offering memoranda that we all see, I mean, sometimes these promises get a little bit insane. But I'd say, yeah, if I was investing passively, I would put a lot of focus on the market, specifically like the little sub market, understand the town that you're going into, and then, you know, pick someone who, I just want to say like track record experience. I know lots of guys who have very extensive track records who I wouldn't necessarily trust. Just, you want it to keep hammering on this, right? Like, you want somebody who you can trust for a variety of reasons, right? Someone who's willing to talk to you, someone who's willing to share like the worst deal they've had, or who is more involved than just sort of at a very high level, strategic, I can buy this thing. I don't care if it's a strip mall or a mobile home park, because I see a revenue gap between the market and this asset. I think that's pretty dangerous. And you know, the advantage of being able to make an accredited investor and being able to make it a, you know, pick one of your properties and invest in Andrew Keel's deal is you get to talk to you and you get to sort of confer all those great benefits. Those would be the big ones to me, is taking advantage of that opportunity where like we don't all get to go talk to like, you know, like yeah. You don't get to talk to like the senior guys at Blackstone or the senior guys at Charles Schwab or whatever. So like, but you do. And, you know, if you're going to make significant investments, like take advantage of that opportunity, really understand who you're working with and understand the town. I'd say those would be the things I would focus on.
Awesome advice, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course.
If any of our listeners would like to connect with you or learn more about what you're doing at Bridgeview Asset Management, what would be the best way for them to contact you?
The website, if you just go to bridgeviewassetmanagement.com, and then, I mean, LinkedIn's probably another good one if you want to. All the stuff we're talking about like affordability, rent control impacts, sort of the future of manufactured housing. I do write pretty extensively on that. So if anyone's interested on the investment front, we obviously do a ton of that too. But yeah, I mean, I'm really passionate about how manufactured housing can solve more problems than most people think it can. So I think that's sort of my main goal with getting to talk to you is kind of just, hopefully we can break down that stigma a little bit. And then hopefully someone listening says, shit, maybe I should go look at some of these. So yeah, that's why I'm so grateful for the time. So thanks again.
Love it. You bet. Yeah. And it takes money to do that, right? It takes money to buy these things and money to improve them. So yeah, really important. Thanks again. That's it for today, folks. If you got value out of this episode, please consider leaving us a review. It really does help us get more listeners. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. Thank you. Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @PassiveMHPInvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @PassiveMHPInvesting on Instagram. See you there.